Good evening. We got partway through chapter 10 a week. I could spend a ton of time reviewing and it'd just be exciting stuff, but it would be going over what we've gone over and be slowing us down a bit. So I'll be picking up a few things on the way by, but basically we saw last week toward the end of the study, chapter 10, beginning at verse 5, woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger. And we're going to come back to that. I'm going to revisit that here in a minute. But I want you to remember that what we covered before that were like four reasons that God was getting after Israel. Four reasons. Let's see if we can reconstruct them. Beginning in verse 8, chapter 9, verse 8, a stubborn pride and arrogance. In chapter 9, beginning at verse 13, people who were led astray and allowing themselves to be led astray, purposely following what they wanted to hear rather than what the word actually says. Beginning then in verse 9, 18, we have the voracious appetite of individuals against each other. They didn't care what they were doing to their neighbors. This, pardon? It was divisive, but it was selfish greed. Selfish greed that didn't care. As long as I can get it from somebody, if it's you, that's fine. And then in chapter 10, 1 through 4, we had the corrupt leadership justice system that was taking advantage of their own powerful position without regard for the people under their jurisdiction. But and so those are some of the issues in society that God found it, issues in society that God took issue with. And he says, in all this, my hand is, how to say it? In all this, his anger is not turned away, and his hand is still stretched out. No response from the people would turn God's anger away, so he kept on spanking them, is the way I read that. But then part of the spanking took place through an agent. Now, if you remember, all the way back in chapter 7, God told Ahaz, who was concerned about those two smaller nations, Israel and Syria, who were threatening to come depose him and set up somebody of their own. God said, it's not going to happen. But if you don't believe, you won't last. So he didn't believe. He hired Assyria to come in and help him rather than trusting God to help him. We'll get back to that point later in tonight's discussion. But since he did that, then the Assyrian came in to take care of the problem. And so rather than delivering Judah from Israel and Syria, Assyria decided that I'll just take them all. I'll just put them all in my grab bag, including Judah. And so what we had then last week, the last half of last week, was the depiction of Assyria coming in to do whatever it wanted to do, take captive and plunder, but coming in as God's agent, not intending to be God's agent, but being God's agent nevertheless. What was the image? What was the picture that he used? Assyria was an axe. An axe in God's hand. God was going to be the lumberjack and Assyria was going to be the axe. And we're going to cut down the forest. Now, oftentimes the forest would be, and we'll see later tonight or next week, depending on how far we get, the forest would be the grand trees of the hierarchy, the elite, and then the bramble bush in the thick of the forest. And we've all seen that big trees and then the shrubbery would be the common people. And I'm just going to take my axe against the whole thing, going to cut the whole thing down using Assyria. And so he said in verse 11 of chapter 10, shall I not do, this is Assyria speaking, shall I not do to Jerusalem and her images just as I have done to Samaria and her idols? In other words, you guys just going to be putty in my hand. I'll get you however I want. But I want then to look at God's rebuke again, use it as a launch point for tonight. Starting in verse 15, 10:15, he says, is the axe to boast itself over the one who chops with it? Now, see, the Assyria was the axe, and God was the chopper. I'm using you to chop down my wood, my forest, but you're bragging about what you're doing. He says in verse 16, therefore, the Lord, Yahweh of hosts, will send a wasting disease among his stout warriors, and under his glory, a fire will be kindled like a burning flame. You're not going to last. You're going to be consumed. But now watch what it says in verse 17. And the light of Israel will become a fire and his Holy One a flame. Now, I didn't highlight that last week, an oversight on my part, but really effective now for the review. Do you remember in chapter 8 with the approach of Assyria that the nation was plunged into darkness, the gloom of darkness? Remember that? The nation was plunged into the gloom of darkness. But in chapter 9, about verse 2, they won't be in darkness any longer when a light begins to shine. Now, I would call that the light of Israel. And you go to Matthew 4, and that verse is quoted, not 10:17, but 9:2, and applied to the ministry of Jesus. So this light here in chapter 10, verse 17, is a reference to Jesus' ministry. I am the light of the world. Okay? And so it would be at that time that the domination that Assyria represented at this time, when we get to chapters 13 and 14, will start to vacillate between Assyria and Babylon. It's like the two are almost the same thing. You come to Daniel, the Nebuchadnezzar's dream. He had a dream of the metal man image, which was all one contiguous statue, which included Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. And it's during the Roman Empire that that entire statue was crumbled. Okay? So when I read here in 10:17, the light of Israel will become a fire and his Holy One a flame, and it will burn and devour his thorns and his briars in a single day. That not Assyria specifically, but what Assyria began to represent, this era of darkness for Israel, that it would be consumed when the Christ came, the Messiah, the light of Israel came. Okay? And what would be left of the opposing force, the trees of his forest, his leaders, his elite, his populace, would be so small that a child could write the number down. And I think the only point there is the decimation of the force that they were now fearing. So you put yourself back in Isaiah's people, and they were dreading, they were shaking like a leaf at the approach of Israel. You remember in chapter 7, they shook like a leaf. But here, the big giant that they hired to help them is going to be worse on them. And God is saying, when the light comes, they're going to be nothing. They're going to be nothing. So he's giving them hope for down on, but right now you got to go through the process. So, new material now, beginning at verse 20. Now it will come about in that day that the remnant of Israel and those of the house of Jacob who have escaped will never again rely on the one who struck them, but will truly rely on Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God, For though your people, O Israel, be like the sand of the sea, a remnant within them will return. A destruction is determined, overflowing with righteousness, a complete destruction, one that is decreed, the Lord Yahweh of hosts will execute in the midst of the whole land. Now, here's an interesting thing. It says it'll come about in that day that a remnant will come back to God. What's going to happen to the rest of them? Yeah, they're going to be
killed or taken away.
Killed, taken away, or died in the siege. You know, died of plague, died of siege, died of starvation, died of sword, or taken off captive and sold in the slave markets. But a remnant will return. Go all the way back to chapter 4 with me on that point. Go all the way back to Isaiah 4. In verse 2, in that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful. Now, in just a little while, when we get to chapter 11, we're going to see a sprout that comes out of the root of Jesse. But here, in that day, the branch of Yahweh will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land will pride and adornment of the survivors of Israel. And it will come about that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy, everyone who is recorded for life. So that back there in our, what we might say, our overture, or what did I call it? The first six chapters.
Yeah.
I think I called it overture, Isaiah's overture. But back there, see, he introduced the idea that there would be a remnant that survived. They were recorded for life. They would be purged and purified. And it would be like coming, I think we even saw the idea of a second Exodus, coming out and being God's light by day and a pillar of smoke by night. They would be guided. We're going to review that, reprise that theme as we go on here. But here it says, back in chapter 10, now verse 20, it'll come about in that day, that is when the light of Israel shines. In that day, the remnant of Israel and those of the house of Jacob who have escaped will never again rely on the one who struck them. What was happening in the as Isaiah was writing this? What was happening?
They had gone to Assyria.
Why did they go to Assyria, Scott?
They didn't trust in God.
Yeah, they had a threat, and they didn't trust God. They didn't rely on God. He says, when we're through with all this process, my people will never again rely on anybody but me. You see how he's going to work this purge and purify the thinking of his people. I love what Habakkuk said in chapter 3, and about verse 15. He says, when he looked at all the devastation that was coming at the hand of God because of the godlessness of the people, he says, you went forth for the salvation of your people. What you do in your wrath was not to destroy things, but to purify and purge things, get rid of the ugly and the impure, and purify the rest. Okay, so in that day, in verse 21, a remnant will return. Isaiah had two sons, right? Jashub and Maher Shalal Hashbaz. Okay, Mahershalal Hashbaz, it's coming quickly. Swift is the booty, speed is the prey. Sheol Jashub, a remnant will return. And we were told there in chapter 8 that your two sons are for signs. I and these two sons are for signs. We're going into captivity, but a remnant will come back. Now, we're going to get the Sheol Jashub, the Mahershalal Hashbaz here in a minute. Okay, so for though your people, O Israel, may be like the sand of the sea, only a remnant will return. I want you to think about what Moses predicted in chapter 28, Deuteronomy 28. Now, I love chapter 32, the Song of Moses. It's got it's like God sketched out his history of redeeming his people from the very beginning. But in chapter 28 of Deuteronomy, the blessings and the curses, especially amplifying the curses, we come over here to 58. If you're not careful to observe all the words of this law, which are written in this book, to fear the honored, awesome name, Yahweh your God, then Yahweh will bring extraordinary plagues on you and your descendants, even severe and lasting plagues, and miserable and chronic sickness. And he will bring back on you all the diseases of Egypt of which you were afraid, and they will cling to you. Also every sickness and every plague which not written in this book of the law, Yahweh will bring them on you until you are destroyed. Then you shall be left few in number, whereas you were as the stars of heaven for multitude. That's what Moses predicted, warned, back before they entered the promised land, just before they entered. Here, they've been there several hundred years and become so corrupt that God said, even though you're like the sea, only a few of you will return. A destruction is determined, overflowing with righteousness, for a complete destruction, one that is decreed, the Lord Yahweh of hosts will execute again in the midst of the whole land. Now, I just finished a study in the book of Daniel, and Daniel, was about 100 years later from Isaiah. Excuse me. He went into captivity, the Babylonian captivity, as a young man. And now in his late, oh my, he must be in his late 80s, he's reading Jeremiah, and he realized from reading Jeremiah that the captivity was going to be 70 years. Well, 70 years is up. Now, if you go into captivity as a 17-year-old and the years are up, how old are you? Like, I'll push a 90. By the way, that's before he went into the lion's den, by the way. And he prayed and confessed and prayed and begged and asked God to have mercy. And in chapter 20, verse 24 through 27 is God's answer. I'm not going to read all of it, but it talks about the overwhelming flood. I'll read 26 and 27. Then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off. That's chapter 9, 26 and 27. You had 77s. You got 7 for rebuilding and then 62. So that's 69 of the 77s. And after the 69th, Messiah will be cut off. Have nothing. The people, the prince who is to come, will destroy the city and the sanctuary. And its end with a flood, even to the end, there will be war. Desolations are determined. And he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering, and on the wing of abomination, one who makes desolate, even a complete destruction, one that is decreed is poured out on the one who makes desolate. So here Daniel, 100 years later, is talking about that same destruction that was decreed. And so God didn't change his mind, but I'm just showing the daisy chain of that. A complete destruction. So verse 24, back in chapter 10, verse 24. Therefore, thus says the Lord Yahweh of hosts, O my people who dwell in Zion, do not fear the Assyrian who strikes you. See, he's going to come in. He's going to cut you down. But when the light of Israel comes, he will be as nothing. A few of you, the faithful few, will come back to me. So don't fear. What did God say to Ahaz back in chapter 7? If you will not believe, you will not last. Here, don't fear. Don't fear the Assyrian who strikes you with the rod and lifts up his staff against you, the way Egypt did, for in a very little while, my indignation will be spent. I've got to punish you, but it's going to be over in a little while. And my anger will be toward their destruction. And Yahweh of hosts will arouse a scourge against him like the slaughter of Midian at the rock of Horeb. Now, the only thing I could come up with that is when Midian had what did he have? 22,000 men, and he said, and God said, that's too many. So he sent home those who were afraid, and I mean, what he still had 10,000. And God said, that's still too many. And so go down to the creek and let's see how you drink. And some put their mug right down in the creek, and others cupped their hands and brought it up. There were 300 of those. God says, I'll deliver Israel with those. And that night, the slaughter of Midian was amazing. And Israel, 300 men, had a trumpet in one hand and a lantern in the other. Where was their sword? They didn't have a sword. They blew the trumpet and shone the light. And the Midianite army thought that they were being besieged from all sides with a mass, and they started killing each other. And that may be what he's talking about here, the slaughter of Midian. And his staff, now what? His staff, God's staff, will be over the sea. And he will lift it up the way he did in Egypt. What happened when Moses lifted up the staff? The sea parted, and there was escape. Okay? So will it be in that day that his burden will be removed from your shoulders and his yoke from your neck, and the yoke will be broken because of fast. What do you think that means? The yoke is his yoke, a serious yoke on you, will be broken because of fast. What do you think? Good.
Well, we know what happened.
Well, we know it's going to be broken when the light shines. So in the days of Jesus, Assyria is long gone, but the domination that Assyria represented was still there. Okay. What do you think? His yoke will be broken because of fatness.
Is it not saying that they
What?
won't have the control over them?
Yeah, that
Like,
the yoke being broken means you're out from under the yoke. Jesus said, take my yoke upon you. Learn from me. It's easy and light. And being guarded and protected and fed by the master, they would flourish. I think that's the picture. That
I was going to mention yoke be broken because of fatness would be because you have so much that you're provided for
Yeah,
that you
I think that's it. You're not out plowing with your neck in a yoke. You are being fed by God.
kind of what happens in when Assyria was just obliterated.
Yeah.
They came in and they took every they got spoils and did nothing. This is a double thing too.
So it's a picture of comfort. See, don't fear. His yoke will be broken and you're going to get fat. Okay?
Because you will
Now,
have plenty.
you'll have plenty. Right. Verse 28. Now, that's the end of God's encouragement regarding what he's doing with Babylon, with Assyria. He's going to come in, he's going to chop you down. You're going to be left few in number, but when the light shines, he will be destroyed and a remnant of you will come back to me. So don't worry, don't fear, don't dread. If you won't believe, you won't last. So you can take that same message. But now we finished the encouragement or the exhortation or the what's the word? Exposition of what God was doing with the Babylon, with the Assyrian. But he says, so now he's turning his attention to something that would be dreadful and frightening. He has come to Aiath. He has passed through Migron. At Michmash, he deposited his baggage. They have gone through the pass, saying, Geba will be our lodging place. Ramah is terrified, and Gibeah of Saul has fled away. Cry aloud with your voice, O daughter of Galim. Pay attention, Laisha, wretched Anathoth. Madmenah has fled. The inhabitants of Gebim have sought refuge. Yet today he will halt at Nob. He shakes his fist at the mountain of the daughter of Zion, the hill of Jerusalem. What in the world is all of that?
That's a lot of name dropping.
Lot of name dropping, yeah. Yeah, and you suppose the people in Jerusalem have heard, oh, that city over there fell, and that city fell, and they can track the progress of him coming, and some of them are in dread of him being there already. But he's going to stop tonight at Nob, and he's going to shake his fist at you. This is a description of what of the terror that must have been in the hearts of Israel as they knew that this was coming. Right now, I heard this on the news tonight. I knew it, but it refreshed. They're expecting pick a river. The Snohomish, pick a river, I don't care which one, to crest at 4 p.m. tomorrow at concrete. And then 4 p.m. the next day at Mount Vernon. What if when the people in Mount Vernon hear that the river has crested at record-breaking heights, 5, 6 feet above the state record for that river, and they hear it up there, they're down here, and they hear that up there it's crested, and they see pictures of the damage. How do they feel down here?
Building fear.
Dreadful. Yeah. Picture that, and then here's Israel hearing the approach of Sennacherib's armies. Wave after wave after wave after wave. Tonight he's going to stop there and wave his angry fist at you, implying, of course, I'm coming to get you. And so, even though we're left with this picture of there's going to be a remnant and it's going to be great and you'll be fat right now, you got this. What does that do to, if you will not believe, you will not last? What do these verses do to that thought? It's easy to believe that God's going to do something really good when you don't have to go through anything really bad to get to it. But these people knew, like Habakkuk knew, the Babylonians coming, and there's not a thing we can do about it. He's going to devastate it, and there's not us, and there's not a thing we can do about it. All we can do is hunker down and wait for God. And it was Habakkuk that said in chapter 2, the righteous shall live by faith. That became Paul's mantra in the New Testament. The righteous shall live by faith. If you will not believe, you will not last. What's another good word for believe? Trust or have faith. Yeah, you will not. It's a common theme. So, we're going to have some really good stuff coming, but you're going to go through some really bad stuff first. Purge and purify. It reminds me of a lot of things in the New Testament. Jesus said in Matthew 24, 13, regarding the tearing down of the temple, what does he say? My mind just totally went blank. No. The one who endures to the end will be saved. The one who endures to the end will be saved. That meant riding out the storm. Okay. All right. Behold, the Lord Yahweh host will top off the boughs with a terrible crash. Which boughs? Verse 28, he has come. That's the king of Assyria. And verse 33, Yahweh's going to top off the boughs. I believe he's talking about Israel or Jerusalem. And those also who are tall, and I'll show you why. Those also who are tall in stature will be cut down, and those who are lofty will be abased. And we've seen that theme already in Isaiah. And he will cut down the thickets of the forest with an iron axe. So you got the tall trees and the thickets. And Lebanon will fall by the mighty one. It was Lebanon.
I
But I think it's a reference to the king's house, because the king's house is called
wouldn't get.
it's called House of the Forest of Lebanon. Okay, so I think that's what he's referring. So yeah, he's coming. He's got his axe. He's swinging. He's gonna clear cut the place. So that kind of leads us into chapter 11. So just to recap, Assyria is bragging about what he's gonna do, and God says, "You shouldn't brag. You're the axe in my hand." And then he says to Israel, "When I'm done with him, I'm going to destroy him, and a few of you are going to come back to me in rich fat." But right now, he's coming. Right now, he's coming, and he's gonna cut this. Don't act in fear. Continue to trust me, but he's coming, and he's gonna clear cut the place. But watch what it says now in chapter 11. Then a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. You know what this reminds me of? That discussion we had a couple. 2 or 3 weeks ago. But what happens when you cut a tree down? There are some trees that will come back up from the roots. Okay, well, God's just cutting his old forest down. But there's going to come back up from the roots of the house of David. The prophecy of the virgin birth was made to whom? King Ahaz, right? But it was addressed to the house of David. You're not house of David. Because Ahaz was of the house of David, but it wasn't just here now. It was addressed to the house of David. David was the son of Jesse. And so now we're going to have this shoot from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. And the spirit of Yahweh will rest on him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and strength, the spirit of knowledge and the fear of Yahweh. And he will delight in the fear of Yahweh. And he will not judge by what his eyes see, or nor make a decision by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the land. And he will strike the land with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Also, righteousness will be the belt about his loins, and faithfulness the belt about his waist, and the wolf will dwell with the lamb. And the leopard will lie down with the kid, and the calf, and the young lion, and the fatling together. And a little boy will lead them. Also, the cow and the bear will graze. Their young will lie down together. And the lion will eat straw like the ox. The nursing child will play by the hole of the cobra. And the weaned child will put his hand on the viper's den. They will not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. The land will be full of the knowledge of Yahweh as the waters cover the sea. Then it will come about in that day that the nations will resort to the root of Jesse, who will stand as a signal to the peoples, and his resting place will be glorious. Oh, I thought you were raising your hand to ask a question.
Yep.
Okay. Did you notice how interesting? I hadn't noticed this until this time through the book, that you've got this sprout coming up out of the chopped down forest. I hadn't picked up on that thought. Now, we saw it in the book of Daniel, how that God cut down or used the image of a tall tree to represent the rule of King Nebuchadnezzar. He says, "You're going to be cut down, but we're going to put a band around the stump. And when you come back to your senses and realize that I'm in charge, I'll give you back your kingdom." And here we have a remnant that's going to recognize we only rely on Yahweh, not on anybody else, just on Yahweh. And so they're given this picture of the sprout, the things coming back to life. Reminds me of Amos 9, where Amos said that. I think he said in the last days, but maybe not. But The reference is certainly, where's Amos? Enjoy. Muttering to myself as I find Amos. Amos Obadiah, there's Amos. Chapter 9 of Amos. Says, I'm going to shake. I'm starting at verse 9. Behold, I'm going to shake. I am commanding, and I will shake the house of Jacob among all the nations. The grain is shaken in a sieve, but not a kernel will fall to the ground. Does that sound like what we just read? I'm going to have a remnant. I'm going to have a remnant. I'm going to cut my whole forest down, but I have a remnant. Here, I'm going to shake the whole house and scatter them like grain is scattered, but I won't, my kernels won't hit the ground. And all the sinners of my people will die by the sword, those who say calamity will not overtake us. In that day, I will raise up the fallen booth. What's a booth? Tabernacle, booth, tent, temporary shelter of David. And wall up its breaches, I will also raise up its ruins and rebuild it as in days of old. He's not talking about a physical structure. He's talking about, well, Edgar Allan Poe wrote The Fall of the House of Usher, and he had in mind, two had in mind, the last two remnants, the last two heirs, brother and sister of the house of Usher, and the house itself, and it burnt down and killed them. So the whole thing, the house. But when he talked about raising up the fallen house of David, he's talking about the lineage. This prophecy was addressed to the house of David, 7. Okay. In the last days, he says, I will raise up fallen house of David. I'm going to have a shoot, a sprig, come out of a cut down tree. And watch this. See, we're going to see that he, and we saw in chapter 9, a son would be given and he would be king. All right. Here in this chapter, the spirit of Yahweh will rest on him, of wisdom and understanding, spirit of counsel and strength. What was one of the outstanding characteristics of Solomon?
Wisdom.
Divinely granted wisdom. And that was experienced primarily where?
Problems.
Well, yeah, we read about it in Proverbs a lot of, but wasn't it applied as he passed judgments for the people, made decisions? And one of the outstanding cases was with the two women and one dead child and one living child. And we said, God, so what I'm getting at is Isaiah is prophesying in a period of time where the judges were corrupt. They took advantage of their position to from whoever would pay them to get the kind of judgment they wanted. But here, when this one comes, he's going to come with the spirit of wisdom and understanding. He's going to come with the spirit of counsel and strength. He's going to come with the spirit of knowledge and the fear of Yahweh. One of the reasons that we have judgments today is because the judges don't care what God said. They don't care what's written in God's word about how to treat people. They just, well, corrupt it at various levels. But he will have the spirit of the fear of Yahweh. I take this to say that when this one comes, this regrowth of the forest, as it were, when he comes, he's going to come with the right kind of ruling attitudes, guiding attitudes, disposition to his people. He will not judge, but he will delight in the fear of Yahweh, and he will not judge by what his eyes see. Here's a beggar. This reminds me a little bit of James 2. Here's a beggar in his ragged clothes, and here's a rich man. And what were they doing in James toward the rich and toward the beggar? Beggar, you sit back here. Or you sit on the floor. Sit or maybe to the rich man. Oh, here, have this choice seat. They were making judgments according to what their eyes saw, the wealth and the prosperity. And I suspect there was a lot of that going on in the courts when Isaiah wrote this. We've read it. nor make a decision by what his ears hear. I think he's talking here about bribes and extortion and things like that that could move a judge. And this guy's not going to be like that. But with righteousness, he will judge the poor and decide with fairness the afflicted of the earth. Now, isn't this exactly what God said from the days of Moses on? And by the way, isn't this what God said, say, through James 1, verse 27? Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to do what? Visit the widows and the orphan need in their affliction and keep yourself unspotted from the world. But God always had this, what I'm wanting for my people is to be gracious and compassionate and generous toward the poor, not just say, oh, I wish things were better. You pull out your wallet and make things better. That's what God was looking for. He will judge the poor, he'll decide fairness to the earth, and he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. Now that you've heard of doing this, that word earth, Hebrew eretz, is like the Greek word ge, which means land or territory. Doesn't mean globe. He's not talking about the globe. He's talking about the land that they knew. And so he will strike that land with the rod of his mouth. You know what that reminded me of, Scott? Devin, you know what that reminded me of? Yeah, Revelation 19. And the heaven was open, verse 11, heaven was open, and a white horse, and him that sat upon it's called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes a flame of fire, and upon his head many diadems, and he has the name written, which no one knows except himself, and he is clothed in a white robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God, and the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen and clean, were following him on white horses, and from his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may smite the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. And I said, wow. Isaiah is saying that that's what this guy who comes from the shoot of Jesse is going to do. What would that mean to the people in Isaiah's day? Always keep in mind the audience that is hearing it for the first time. We have a tendency to say, I want to see these prophecies through our worldview or through our conclusions that we've drawn about the Bible and not spend a lot of time of seeing these through the experiences of the people that were being written to. Don't fear the Assyrian. I heard about the Syrian and the Israeli armies, and they were trembling like leaves on a tree when shaken by the wind, chapter 7. Don't fear them. Here, this one that's coming, who's going to put an end to the domination that you're under, and your yoke's going to be broken. He is going to smite them for you. He is going to bring to an end their terror. He'll judge the poor with righteousness, and he'll strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips, he'll slay the wicked. So we've got this caring for the needy and the righteous, and protecting them by taking care of the wicked. He says in verse 5, also, righteousness will be the belt about his loins, and faithfulness the belt about his waist. What's the picture there, do you think? A belt of righteousness and faithfulness. You go to the armor in Ephesians 6. What does that belt do? Holds everything else in its proper place. It's a place where all the belt that he wore, place where all of the weapons of that his disposal would be hanging from that belt. And so it's going to be righteousness and faithfulness. And the wolf will dwell with the lamb. The picture, 6 through 6 and 7. Is it 6 through 8? Summarize it, or categorize it, or generalize it, to classify it. What is it? What's the picture? Broad view.
Getting together.
Getting together, okay?
There will be no danger.
Things that
No danger, Alan says.
well, things are usually opposed to each other are fear of one is fear and one is a part of one.
Yeah.
Either.
Yeah. And they're together without harm. Or naivety. A little child. Oh, look, there's a really nice little hole. What's in the hole? A viper's in there. Now, you would think what? That he's in big trouble. But the answer is and I mean you see all of these things. The young boy can be leading these. There's peace, there's harmony, there's no fear. And then verse 9, they will not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. Where did we read about Holy Mountain?
True.
Where did we read about it? In Isaiah. It'll come about in the last days of the mountain of the house of the Lord will be lifted up as chief of the mountains. Chapter 2. So we've got this theme continues. In that mountain, my holy mountain, they won't hurt or destroy. Now, will they hurt or destroy outside of that mountain? People will. People still do. But in his mountain, that's not the character of the people.
Does that mountain stand for?
Go ahead.
Yes.
Yeah, it stands for the kingdom of the mountain of his house. And Jerusalem was built on a mountain, so the image was carried over. Cities would be built on high places because of their inapproachability under a siege. It makes them all the more difficult to capture, especially if they have a wall. It's been said that Jerusalem might fall into the Romans had not
Actions.
had not the factions within ate each other up. They had plenty of stories of weather a siege, but they anyway, read about that in the book of Revelation where one third, one third, one third, a third of the, yeah, anyway, not to press that point. The point here is that in God's holy mountain there was this comfort and peace. Outside of it, you're on your own.
But many people take this to think it's animals.
Yeah, it's
It's not.
if they take this to be animals, then they're ignoring what happened in chapter 5, where the vine was people. You are my vine. The vineyard of the Lord is the house of Israel. And so the metaphors are overlooked. Yeah, this is taking beasts that would normally be at each other's throat or be in grave dread, having no hostility or fear. Okay, Linda?
Do you remember that story we heard down in LA about the two Christians who got to talking and
Yeah. It was when Sam was in a protracted meeting, and afterwards they went over to one of the elders' houses. All the elders were there, and Sam just got to inquiring. And there was white and black elders, and the black elder had in his youth involved in the Watts. And one of the white elders had been, in his youth, a policeman patrolling the Watts riot. You talk about being opposite sides. Okay? It's like the police and George Floyd in our generation. And yet here they were shepherding God's flock together in peace because of this one who, this root, or from the root of Jesse, with this spirit. And of course, the teachings that we get from him, tame the wild beast inside, or encourage the timid one, and we can be together without fear. They will not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. And I just want to emphasize that the blessings that God is talking about are in the holy mountain, not in the world around it. And excuse me. Then it will come about in that day that the nations will resort to the root of Jesse. Well, resort to the root of Jesse. Back up in verse 1, the shoot from the root of Jesse. They will resort to him, who will stand as a signal for the peoples. What's a signal? Other versions say a stand, flag, okay? Something that the you hold the flag up and you're at the front of the army, you can see it, or the front of the crowd, but someone way in the back of the crowd can see it as well. And so the nations will resort to the root of Jesse, who will stand as a signal for the peoples, and his resting place will be glorious. A couple of thoughts I want to talk about on this one. In John chapter 12, John 12, somewhere around verse 32. Jesus in 27 says, "Now my soul has become troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name." There came a voice, therefore, out of heaven, "I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again." The multitude, therefore, who stood by and heard it, were saying that it had thundered. Gives you an idea of how loud it was, that voice that they heard. Others were saying, "An angel has spoken to him." Gives you an idea of what they thought the voice of an angel was like. Now we sing, "Soft as the voice of an angel." That wasn't what they thought. They thought it had thundered. Jesus answered, verse 30, and said, "This voice has not come for my sake, but for yours." I didn't need to know that I glorified it, will glorify it again. I already knew that. But I wanted you to hear it. I wanted you to hear it. Now he says, judgment, verse 31, judgment is upon this world. Now the ruler of this world shall be cast out. And I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself. But he was saying this to indicate the kind of death by which he would die. Here we have in Isaiah, he will be lifted up, who will stand as a standard, who will stand as a signal to the people and draw. Isn't that what Jesus said here in John 12? That Jesus realized that he was fulfilling what God had promised in Isaiah. And his resting place will be glorious. What does that mean? His resting place will be glorious. I got a couple thoughts for you. "Come unto me, all ye who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." His resting, not where he rests, but the resting place he provides for the people who've been abused by the corrupt leadership, for the people who have been downtrodden and misrepresented and ignored. "I will give you rest. I will give you rest." In the book of Hebrews, chapter 2, I think it's 4. I think it's chapter 4. Yeah, it's 4. And he said in verse 1, "Let's fear lest while a promise remains of entering his rest, any one of you should seem to come short of it." Jesus, "Come unto me, all you who labor and heavy laden, I'll give you rest." But he said in Matthew 24:13, "The one who endures to the end will be saved." You got to go through some really rough stuff to enter that rest, he was telling them. And so there's a promise. For them, it was remaining, a promise remaining to enter that rest. "For indeed, we have had the good news preached to us, just as they also. But the word they heard didn't profit them, because why didn't?" I mean, they heard God telling us, "Come follow me." John chapter 4, chapter 6, Jeremiah chapter 6 said, "Look out, find the good way. The right way, and you'll find the rest, and we'd walk there." So they heard, but it didn't profit them because it was not united by faith in those who heard. We who have believed enter that rest. Just as we said, I swore my wrath, they shall not enter. The unbelieving, the godless, those who wouldn't follow, won't enter, but we do. Although his works were finished from the foundation of the world, for he has thus said somewhere concerning the seventh, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. Where you'd find that in Genesis, wouldn't you? God rested. And again in this passage, they shall not enter my rest. Implies what? God rested and he wanted people to rest with him. But those who didn't take what he said and applied it by faith, it will not believe, you will not laugh, weren't worthy to enter that rest. Okay? Since therefore it remains for some to enter it, and those who formerly had good preached to them failed to enter because of disobedience, he again fixes a certain day, today, saying through David, after so long a time as it has been said before, today if you hear his voice, don't harden your heart. Now, they already had what from Mount Sinai? Remember the Sabbath to keep it. They already had the Sabbath rest. And what did Joshua give the people? The promised land. Okay? If Joshua had given them rest, so the promised land wasn't the rest. And obviously, when David said, don't harden your heart, David was implying that the rest of God was still waiting for the people. It wasn't the Sabbath, and it wasn't the promised land. It was something else. Okay? There, verse 9, there remains therefore a Sabbath rest for the people of God. And it's not the Sabbath day, and it's not the promised land. What is it? Jesus Christ. That's the rest. Okay? So, then it will come about in that day. That is the day when the shoot sprouts, the day when the lights come back on, the day when the light removes the threat of the foreign powers. In that day, the nations will resort to the root of Jesse, who will stand as a signal for the peoples, and his resting place will be glorious. You can have a glorious rest in Jesus Christ in that day. Well, that's exactly as far as I said to get. I looked at the material, I thought, oh, we can probably finish chapter 12. And I'm right, we can next week. So one more time, chapter 7 through 12, all the way through. And then we'll finish 11 and 12. 12 is only 6 verses long. So we may be able to finish it in the time allotted. Any thoughts? Genuinely appreciate you being here.